Accession number 28699, reel number 9.
Mr. Casey, reel 9. The breakthrough came along in late August of 44, and what are your memories of that? Did you go through the Falaise Gap area first?
Oh, yes, yes. The memory I've got, first of all, is the cattle, dead cattle everywhere. Dead Germans as well, but mostly cattle, all blown up, bursting, a terrible smell. But then it was the swarms of wasps. And I remember we were going along, and then there's this ahead. I saw this mass, and what the hell's that? And then it's wasps. And I had a map case, and we just drove straight as fast as we could. And I was swinging the map case, so that I was sort of knocking the wasps out the way. There must have been millions. It was just solid with wasps, which attracted by the cattle, I suppose. But that's a vivid memory, that of the wasps. And I was terrified of that. I'd get stung, but I wasn't. I managed to keep them off with a map case.
What were the views and sights you were seeing going through the gap area where the...
Well, as I say, it was mostly, places blown up and all that. But some casualties, well, quite a few casualties, really. But it was the cattle. Cows and that everywhere, and some had burst, some were blown up, and it was like going through a strange land, deserted land. There was very little opposition at first.
Yeah, they basically really clashed, hadn't they?
Yeah.
You had to get across the Seine, I think it would be the first river, wouldn't it?
That's yes. Right, yes, yes. I remember about, it might have been a bit later than that, that we went to an orders group, and the corps commander, Horrocks, General Horrocks, and he was giving his talk. It was later, I think, and he was saying that the Germans had enough for one more big counter-offensive. And they'd come through 280 tanks or something they had, he thought. But they would stretch themselves out, and the supplies would go, and we'd knock them for 6. So we're looking forward to it. And he's got all these maps, you see, and the map where he got these flags stuck in the map at the top, where he expected them to come. And I said to the fella sitting next to me, "That's us there, you see, where the flags are, that's us." And I said, "I've got the carry platoon, and I'm on the right of the battalion, and I'll have a couple of men in an outpost, and they'll be the first one to see these 280 tanks. So I'm not thrilled to bits at this story." And in fact, they came below us into the American zone.
This was the Christmas, probably the Christmas.
Yeah, it was Battle of the Bulge. It came.
Yes. On the actual, the initial breakthrough and the race up into Belgium and so forth, you would come across the French civilians at this time, no doubt.
Oh, yes, yes.
What kind of reception were you getting going through the towns and villages?
Very good. That was very good. As I said before, it was only in the beginning in Normandy that there was a bit of resentment because they'd had a good time and now they'd lost the cattle and things. But further on, it was better. And, when we got toward Belgium and that, it was great. And, I mean, Brussels was just fantastic. You couldn't get through.
Before we get to Brussels, did you come across the French resistance movement this time?
Yes. Yes, and it varied. I mean, when we were doing one, we'd moved on, and the tanks, this is when we went in at the 7th Armoured Division, and the tanks had gone through and were miles ahead, you see. And the colonel said that in this large village, small town, whatever it was, he said, we believe there are Germans about a company or something, but they want to give up. So take your couple of sections of Bren carriers, or a section of Bren carriers, that was, and round them up. Well, as we went along, we came to this road, and on one side was the railway, and on the other side was the river, and this road is stuck on top. And we're going along there, and a gendarme out of the Free French thing was with us, and he was all for, hurry up, get on, you know. And I suddenly heard tanks. So I stopped my carriers, and I said, I presume they're ours, we don't know. So I'll walk ahead. And he's shouting, ah, Viet, Viet, Viet. And I said, listen, mate, the war's over for you. We're going to Berlin. So we'll tell you how fast to go. So I walked about 30, 40 yards, and suddenly round the corner, I saw an 88 German gun. So I ran back, shouted to the lads, out the carriers, into the river. So they all got out and jumped in the river. And these three tanks, I think they were, I forget what, whether, anyway, it doesn't matter. Tigers, I think they were Tiger tanks. Anyway, they came along. Now they tried to fire down as they came along, but they couldn't. We were in the river bank, so they couldn't hit anybody, and they weren't stopping. But they brewed up four carriers. And this gendarme, I never saw him again, he was miles away. And afterwards, I had to report to the colonel, to John Mogg, and I was soaking wet, so when we got back, I got my sergeant's greatcoat, you see. So I go and see John Mogg, and he said, what the hell are you wearing? I said, this is my sergeant, sir. I said, you know those fellas who want to give up? Yes, I said, the transport turned up for them. Three bloody Tiger tanks. He said, good God. I said, yes, you've lost four Bren carriers, but nobody's been killed. And I've wet my suit. I've got a borrowed coat. Oh. So I said, do you think you could find out a bit more accurately next time if somebody wants to give up? So we used to have a lot of laughs like that, because I always said things in a funny way to him, you know.
Did you actually see any of the collaborators being dealt with by the French?
Yes, and we didn't like it at all. I saw some women being marched, with their bald heads, their heads cropped, and some of these, and people around shouting, screaming at them. And I said to the fellow with me, I said, well, the only ones with any dignity are the women. And I said, these bastards, you know. And I was very angry with them. I didn't know what, these women had obviously slept with the Germans or something, but what do you do? I mean, you know, when you're in that situation, I don't know, but I thought these, you know, I said, now they're being brave, you know. And I know we got some Free French doing a thing with us, and well, it was like kids playing, you know. They were wanting to fire the rifles, and we felt very professional next to them, that's all I can say. And I had this view that we're going a long way, mate, and it's all over for you.
But did they help you to point towards Germans in the neighbourhood as you were moving?
Not me. I never got anything out of them. I just, as I say, on one occasion we had about 8-9 Free French with rifles, and they didn't contribute at all, really. They were just, I thought they were a bit of a nuisance. And then this gendarme, but then I saw these women, and I strongly disapproved of that.
Did you come across any Germans on the pursuit, stragglers or rear guard?
Oh, yes. You know, there were people who did want to give up, you know, and so, you know, they were sent back. We didn't have much action then on that part. We got some later, but that little bit we didn't, except, as I say, four of my carriers were blown up.
And then you move forward, of course, into the First World War and the 1940 area up in the north of France. What's your memories of that, you know, the old First World War battlefields? You'd pass through that area, no doubt.
Well, yes, but as I say, it's all a bit vague, in the sense that really you just thought, where do we go today? And either you went to somewhere to take up position, or you had an attack in another village, or you had to do a night thing. But where you were and what was happening there, you weren't too sure. It was all a bit vague most of the time. You just knew your objective, really. Or you would stop somewhere, and then you had to have a defensive area. I mean, I remember when we had moved forward, and my platoon, carry platoon, were on the right, extreme right, which we often did. And the colonel said, "There's nobody on your right. The Germans are about half a mile ahead, but there's somebody moving on your right. But I want to know who it is." Well, suddenly you hear these voices. "Hi, Jake, what's going on?" You see. So I got up to the colonel and I said, "I think it's the Americans somehow." And it's a funny situation. It sounds like a joke, but it was true. He said, "Well, make contact with them." So I went over and I climbed this hill, and one man stood up, tall, gangling fella. I said, "Hi, sir." I said, "Oh, good. Where's the rest of your men?" He said, "Oh, they're down in that that house down there." Oh, so I went down the house, and this fella said, "I said, you've only got one man up there. You will be having more tonight, won't you?" He said, "Oh, he's a Red Indian. He's half Red Indian." He said, "He can smell about half a mile." And he said, "He gives a signal, we'll come up there and shoot." And I said, "Well, I'd really like it if you could have a few more up Winston trenches." It was a comedy scene. He said, "We're the Rangers, you know. We get all the shit." I said, "Oh, when did you come?" He said, we flew from America 2 days ago." "Oh," I said, "I see." He said, "When did you come?" I said, "D-Day." He said, "Jeez, fellas, this guy landed on D-Day." "And what have you got?" I said, "Well, I've got so many Bren carriers, and, you know, we have Bren guns, but we also have one or two German guns we've fitted on." And he said, "Gee, you could have stopped Ronstadt on your own." I said, "No, I'd have needed a little bit of help, I think, for 280 tanks. Anyway, I went back to the colonel and I said, "Well, I don't know what they're going to be like, but," I said, "they get all the shit, you know. They've been here 2 days." That was the first contact, you know. And so I said to the colonel, "You will stand by if I give a shout, won't you, if we need any help?"
What are your memories of Brussels, which was quite a situation?
Well, not a lot, except the fact we couldn't stop, you see. We went straight through. The crowds. You had great difficulty in getting through. And everybody was throwing flowers and offing you bottles, and all the women getting up to kiss you. And it was a fantastic move going through Brussels. But unfortunately, we weren't allowed to stop. And we pulled up about 4 miles outside. And that's where Brian Gardner...
We have Brian Gardner's story.
Yeah, that's where he went in and lost his Jeep. But we stopped there for just a few hours.
Yeah, I think the
next day we moved on.
Yeah, the hope was that you might stay there a little while, but you moved on then because the Bataan was involved in the brigade attack over the Albert Canal at Geel.
That's right, yes, God, yes.
Do you remember?
Now, that might... Would that be the one where the colonel said my carriage couldn't go across? Could have been. Or if we had a bridgehead, we'd go across.
I think that...
Can't remember.
There was a brigade action, and... the 8th went over first, and then the 6th, and then the 9th went over on the right flank.
Ah, yes, that's
and,
right.
And the carriers may have crossed over a bridge or an engineer's bridge or something, which was under fire at the time.
Do
you have memories of that particular action, which wasn't very action? Wasn't a very pleasant action.
No, and I think that's where I was telling you about stopping the night. We dug in the slit trenches, and... you know, and the major saying they hadn't to get out all night. But I remember that because I crushed and we got our feet wet. And, you know, they must have been soaking wet for hours. And it was God knows how, freezing. The main thing was we were hemmed in by all this artillery. Corps of artillery was just firing on our area, battalion or whatever it was. There were quite a few prisoners there, because I remember Sergeant Major taking some back. And then there were people coming up digging graves. That's the other thing I remember about that. But it was one of those things. There was nothing we could do. Nobody to shoot at. We just had to stay there.
Yeah, the Germans did put in severe counterattacks.
Oh, yes.
Some of them were German Air Force units, actually, grounded Air Force.
Yes.
Units.
Yes.
And the fighting went on for 2 or 3 days, I think.
That's right. That's right.
And you were on the right flank.
Yeah. And I have a feeling that that's where, at one point, there was a counterattack, and there were odds and sods. SS officers had collected all the sort of cooks and bottle washers and launched an attack. And I can remember one of them shouting, "We die for Hitler." And one of my lads shooting said, "Die, you bastard." So these things make me laugh, you know. And that's when I think one of the fellows was digging the slit trench for one of these cooks or bottle washers after the attack. Because it failed. There may have been more than one, but it was all along the line, different.
Yeah, there was 2 or 3 days fighting, and then
yeah.
You were withdrawn and the Scottish division took over, and the next day they just walked into the town.
Yes, that's right. That's
but
right.
Then, of course, then you moved on into Holland.
Oh, yes, Holland. I liked Holland.
And over the bridges and into Nijmegen.
Nijmegen. Now, Nijmegen, we were just below Nijmegen, below the river, in Nijmegen, actually, yes, because we had sort of billets there, or friends, Dutch friends. They were wonderful, the Dutch, to us. And I don't know whether I told you about the going to find the bar. Well, we were there, and the situation was, in the daytime, nothing, because there was a big expanse, half a mile ahead, you know. But at night, there were patrols, and it was terribly cold. I also remember a pal of mine, 6'4", coming in where I'd got a bit of a fire going, and he was crying with his feet, the cold. It was a weird sight to see this great big man weeping with his cold. He's frostbitten almost, I think. Anyway. We heard that there was an officers' club had opened up about 10 miles back, you see. So, four of us, including Roy Griffiths, who was second in command of my company, we got the jeep and went back and found this place. And of course, it was surrounded by officers, you know, people doing military office work. Anyway, we got back, banged on this door, and this captain opened the door, and we pushed in and said, "Right, bottle of whiskey to start with." He said, "The general has laid down strict orders. Nobody can have a drink until after office hours." So Roy Griffiths, who played for Cardiff as a forward, he was a tough lad, he got hold of him by the throat like Dick Morecambe used to do. And he shook him, and he said, "We're not in offices, we're in slit trenches, and we might be dead tomorrow, and you're going to be bloody dead today unless you get a bottle of whiskey on that counter now." So this fella put it on, he said, "I protest, I report." He said, "You do what you like." So I think, I don't know how many bottles we had, but we got stoned and drove back. How, I don't know, but we drove back in this jeep and then kind of sobered up as quickly as we could. But the idea was so appalling that you had to wait for office hours to get... I had no idea what we were doing. Oh, Roy had him back. So it was funny. And
the population was very friendly, presumably.
Oh, yeah, Holland was wonderful. They couldn't do enough for you. There was a family I met, and they were great, you know. Lovely people. and they just loved the British. They weren't so keen on the Americans. I don't know why, but they loved the British.
And it was a bit hairy crossing the bridge, which was still under German artillery.
Oh, yes, time. Yes, yes, yes. But, memories of Nijmegen are just great, you know. I suppose we did get shot at and things, but
there was some fighting. Yes. In Nijmegen. And then it was nicknamed the island, wasn't it, because of its,
that's right,
of its conditions. Which
that's right, and that's where we were in Switzerland, as you see. And as I say, at night time, patrols kept coming in. And that's where I think it was the Rhine, wasn't it? Yeah. And we took over from a battalion, I think they were Americans. And Colonel Mogg told us when he came back, he went over there, he said, they're incredible, Jim, fantastic. And he said the colonel looked like sort of half Red Indian. And he said, he showed me the positions. And he said, after a couple of minutes, I realised he was showing me from the Germans' point of view, because we were about 200 yards in front of all their troops. So he said, I think I've got the picture now, Colonel. And he said, I got back. And he said, I'm sitting there in his room, and in came the dirtiest soldier I've ever seen, with about a 3-4 day growth of beard. And he said, hi, Colonel. And the Colonel said, hi, Jake, what's cooking? And he said, but this fella then made his report. He had been across the Rhine on his own for 3 days. He'd got taken notes of everything that passed and all this sort of stuff. He said, just on his own. And he rode across. And he came back and reported. And the colonel said, OK, Jake, go and have a rest, boy. And he said, then I discovered that they'd sent an officer and a few men rode across. And they came back with an officer and about 20 German prisoners who they rowed across. And they'd been over there for about 4 days, and they'd picked up, in German uniform, of course, and they'd picked up Germans. And he said, because they are a patrol unit, and they all speak fluent German, they're all second generation Germans. So he said, fantastic people. I said, well, you won't ask us to do that, will you, Colonel? Because my lads speak fluent Geordie. And that doesn't go down well with Germans. He said, oh, God, no, I wouldn't expect any of my lads to do it.
In the October, November 44, the conditions were coming pretty grim on the island.
Yes.
With the weather conditions. Yeah. Was there a fear that the Germans might breach the dikes and flood it?
No, I don't think we... I don't think at that time we ever thought the Germans had a chance. We just thought it's going to take time and it's going to take casualties, but they've had it. You know, we had this confidence then, having got there, that it's just a question of time before we finish it.
Operation Market Garden, of course, went on.
That's right, yes. Oh, we saw those all go over. Hundreds of gliders.
Can you describe to me, we've passed the point, we shouldn't have done, but when you were down in Belgium, can you describe to me when Horrocks was in effect cut off from his headquarters?
Oh, yes.
You were involved in that, weren't you?
Yeah, well, the Germans had cut the line behind our tanks and behind Horrocks' headquarters. So he'd come down and was at our place, and then they discovered the road was cut. So the colonel said, and the intelligence officer had to take him with a section of carriers or a couple of carriers back to his headquarters, which we did. And we went on all little tracks and whatnot and got him back to his headquarters. And he shook hands with all of us and was thrilled to bits. And, you know, it was like he'd been in it again, you know. And I said to the other fella, I said, I wouldn't have the heart to tell him, but at 2 o'clock in the morning, me and the intelligence officer did it in a jeep to make sure it was safe to get through all. He read the map and I drove the jeep, and we got found all these little trails and things and got to his headquarters, and then we came back. So that when we went in the morning, whatever it was, 6 o'clock, 7 o'clock, we'd already made sure it was okay. And I said, I wouldn't have the heart to tell him because he feels so great about having got there through, you know, dodging the Germans. And what they call him, Roy Griffiths mentioned it in your book, that he suddenly saw me coming up the road with General Horrocks in my carrier. Yeah.
Had you been mentioned in dispatches by this time? You were mentioned.
Yes, yes. That was twice I was. First time was when we came back. Peter put... sorry. God. Just stop it a second. Peter Thompson and I went back to England on a course to learn to do what we'd been doing for about 3 months. Sorry. But it was the fact that we were two of the few who was landed on D-Day, and so John Mogg gave us the course. And it was great because we didn't do anything. After the first day or two, the captain running it, we were the only veterans. All the others were second lieutenants on the course. And he'd say, how you do a patrol, that's how you do it. And I'd say, no, you go in front, one man, all this stuff. So after a couple of days, he'd say, I don't think you need a bullet coming tomorrow morning, gentlemen. There's only time. And it was great because my wife had come up. She was in the ATS. And she'd come up to Richmond. And we had a couple of weeks holiday. Anyway, when I got back, the colonel, we looked at the board, and Peter had got an MC, and I got a mention in dispatches. See? And I walked into the mess with Peter, and there was Rumble with an MC. And I thought, oh, I can't stand this. So he was talking to two second lieutenants who was a bit starry-eyed, you know. So I was very naughty, but I went up to him and I said, hello, the MC. When did you get that? Oh, he said, you know, they just come up. I said, nah, that's it. The modesty, you see, modesty. I said, now, you must have an idea. You can't have done that many brave things. He said, well, in Normandy. I said, well, I was in your company in Normandy. I don't remember you doing anything brave, you see. And he said something else, and then I said something else, and he just got up and walked out the mess. And these two lads are looking at me, and I said, I'm sorry about that. But I said, he'll get you killed, lads. He won't get killed, but he'll get you killed. So don't you take notice of what he tells you. And the next day, we saw the colonel. And he said, you two are improperly dressed. And Peter said, no, sir, we're incorrectly dressed. He said, never mind that. You get your ribbon up and you get your oak leaf. And Peter said, well, we didn't think we'd bother, sir, because everybody was getting them. He said, never mind all that dirty rubbish. You do what you're told. So that's when I got mentioned, and I got another one later.